TrueCar is changing car buying forever. TrueCar helps car buyers get rid of the fear that they might overpay. Just in the first 6 months of this year, over 275,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network, and TrueCar users save an average of $3,221 off MSRP. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com to find out what others paid for the car you want. Then register to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step is simple. Just print out your savings certificate, take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. To see how much you can save on the car you want, simply download the TrueCar mobile app. That's right. Download the TrueCar mobile app or visit TrueCar.com today. That is TrueCar, TrueCar.com.
This is Corolla Digital.
Welcome, Dr. Drew Podcast. Those, of course, are those swinging sounds. Chris, on the Adam and Dr. Drew Podcast, I promoted that for you. Well, you did it with me, to be
for
fair.
Us.
You were there for us.
Yeah.
So we'll see how
for
it goes.
Show.
We'll see if people actually listen. Anything else I need to do? Support the pirate ship. Get the swinging sounds available on iTunes and drdrew.com/music. And, of course, do all your shopping on Amazon by clicking through the banner at drdrew.com. Does not cost you anything extra, but keeps the pirate ship afloat and keeps Corolla happy with the team here.
And tell a friend, too, if you like this show.
Yeah, these two get employed. I get a chance to sit here and do this and to talk about interesting, important topics. And today is no exception. I've got Dr. Joseph Ventura. The website is schizophrenia.ucla.edu. Dr. Ventura is a senior research psychologist and faculty member at the UCLA Department of Psychiatric Services. Let's talk about your program. You sent me a little email, and it fascinated me. And I think what I was – before I let you answer my diatribe here – one of the things that is hot in the public conversation these days is people with major psychiatric conditions who are not getting adequate treatment for a variety of reasons, whether it's access to resources, available resources, coverage for resources, family in denial, lack of information, whatever it might be. We've got all kinds of things, and we end up with an Adam Lanza. And so I'd like somewhere across the course of what we talk about address things like that. So go ahead. Tell us about your program.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you very much for allowing me to be on the program. I'm very excited to be here to talk about the UCLA Aftercare Research Program. It's a specialty clinic within the Department of Psychiatry that specializes in the treatment of people who are in the early course of schizophrenia.
So let's describe what that is. We're going to break everything down. We have the time to do it. Let's do it. So what does that mean? What does that look like?
Well, what it looks like is somebody who might be attending high school, be a high school senior.
Or early college.
Yeah. Everything seems to be going well for that person. They have some friends and they're studying and doing well. And then all of a sudden they start hearing something, like they may hear some whispering. And the whispering might be telling them things like, you know what, your classmates really don't like you as much as you think that they do. And that is a bit startling to the person. And so initially, they might ignore something like that. Another possibility would be that they look around and people give them a furtive glance that looks a little angry, a little mean. And ordinarily, you would just slough it off and say, oh, well, somebody's had a bad day. But when you're starting to develop schizophrenia, you might think, oh, well, that person really doesn't like me. And then the thought develops a little further into that person doesn't like me and may intend harm towards me. And then it could get progressive from there, where it's not only that individual, but he's already talked to several other people, and there's a conspiracy brewing to indicate that this person is going to come to some harm. That
they're going to do something to you.
Yeah.
And at that point, is that usually when they report their symptoms, or is that when family begins to talk about it, or how does it come to your attention?
Well, the truth of the matter is that it really varies quite a bit. Some people try to cope with these kinds of experiences by keeping them to themselves.
Right.
Some people might share about it to a family member, and then a family member doesn't recognize the importance of it and doesn't want to talk about
it with
other people.
What you're describing is more often the case, is it not? People just – because, you know, there are people that have weird conspiracy theories every day and or who are irritable and kind of – we're sort of accustomed to paranoid people these days.
We are accustomed to that. I think things are changing lately. So if you said, how was it about 5 years ago, I would say, yes, that's what would happen.
Why? What do you think that is?
I actually think it's the popular media. I think there are many excellent movies now, like A Beautiful Mind, that starred Russell Crowe, The Soloist, that starred Jamie Foxx.
That Soloist, none of people saw that one. That was a fantastic, because I've never seen the explanation quite so vividly, or at least honestly, about trying to house somebody with these kinds of illnesses. They don't want it.
Right.
They push it away.
Right.
For various reasons.
Right. And this guy was a creative genius, so it decreased the stigma a little bit. And the idea that he wanted to be on his own also made him seem like he wanted to be independent. So there was a little bit of like, oh, well, okay, yeah, maybe I can. Maybe I am experiencing some of those kinds of things.
Nice. All right. So they're having these early symptoms, which are auditory hallucinations, often persecutory, right, which you're describing, the paranoia slowly developing. What are the symptoms? Anything else that that might be subtle that people could miss?
Well, here's where it could be subtle. The person himself or herself might be talking but not quite making sense. And he might not be aware of it, but other people might be aware of it. So there's a little bit of a disorganization of the speech and thought process such that other people notice, gee, you're not quite on target. You're not quite on point. You're talking about a lot of stuff and you're giving me a lot of details, but I don't know what you're trying to say.
Yeah.
So in that case, then you'd have to be more highly trained and sophisticated to understand the significance of that. But that would be in a person who usually is articulate and easy to understand.
Do people come to treatment at that early stage typically? It's my experience always been they have to decompensate before anybody gets to them.
Yeah, I think your experience, is pretty accurate with what's really happening. What the key factor is distress. If a person experiences distress as a result of any of these experiences, they're more likely to seek help. If they're not distressed by it for some reason, then they're more likely to try to keep it to themselves.
And then the family has to experience distress too, or you know, concern, if not distress. And oftentimes, again, they're in denial about it. They're trying to understand it their own way. They're taking it to their clergy. So how do we get them to understand these things, see these things, get them in the door?
Right. I think the way to do that is to educate people in the school system, because that's the place where somebody might go and say to a counselor, you know, I'm having some odd experiences. Things don't look right. Things look funny to me. People are giving me funny looks. I'm not sure what to make of it. And if they felt comfortable enough to share it soon, then they can get some attention for it.
What's the current level of understanding in probability, what's going on in the brain at that point in the disease process?
Well, probably schizophrenia has already, if somebody manifests schizophrenia after these subtle symptoms, it's already there's already some issues with the amount of tissue that's in the brain, or there's neurotransmitter abnormalities that are occurring. So there are certain brain chemicals that you're aware of, like dopamine and serotonin. And when they're not quite aligned properly, you'll get some of these experiences.
And you say the tissue, so there's some brain destruction associated with schizophrenia.
Right. There's some areas where there's not enough tissue that's needed.
Which areas?
Well, that would be the frontal lobes or the temporal lobe. More recently, there's been a lot of attention on white matter tracts, because white matter tracts is how the various parts of the brain communicate with each other. So that's why this condition is so difficult to treat and understand. If the tissue damage isn't there, then it might be the connection between the areas of the brain, like the frontal lobes, like the temporal lobes, and that's where the difficulty occurs.
Who's doing that research on the tracts, the white matter?
Well, actually, at UCLA, one of our colleagues who unfortunately is deceased recently, Dr. George Batsokas, is a pioneer in the area of the white matter tracts.
What do they call that technique they use where they have you can show the directionality of the flow? It's a water. It's a water vibration. They're looking at the functional MRIs or something.
Diffusion tensor imaging. Yeah,
and that's really where they're seeing that now. That's been the big breakthrough.
Yeah, that's been one of the breakthroughs. Yes.
And anything new coming along those lines in terms of the imaging of the tracks?
Well, I think what's really the newest is that just the imaging is getting a lot clearer. You can see the structures more clearly. You can measure the damage or the lack of tissue more clearly. So there's also electrical stimulation of the brain.
And is it lateralized, the damage?
It's mostly on the left side, but it is lateralized, yes.
And what area of the temporal lobe and the frontal lobes?
Well, it's the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex.
Okay. Now, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is the ventromedial and dorsolateral prefrontal cortex are the areas that have been hot areas of research in psychiatry, really psychology, mm-hmm. even more than psychiatry perhaps, for the last good 10 years, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the ventrolateral, you said. Did you say – you said ventrolateral or dorsolateral?
Dorsolateral.
Dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. Normally, what does that system do?
What it does is allows us to be able to reflect on our own behavior. It allows us to project into the future. It allows us to plan what we're going to do. And it keeps us aware of ourselves as a person separate from other people.
The dorsolateral – I'm trying to think about other things.
Dorsolateral.
It doesn't also regulate affects to some extent, or is that more ventromedial?
Ah, well, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex in relationship to the amygdala helps regulate emotion. So if you have the amygdala, of course, is the emotional seat of the brain.
And the but sort of more negative or fear emotions?
Fear emotions, but positive emotions
also,
as well.
Okay.
So, right. So your amygdala is reacting.
Amygdala, I think of it as something it makes note of. It makes note.
It gives
a what's the word I'm looking for? A
register?
It registers an emotion. It notes emotions. You know,
Right. So our amygdala right now,
valence.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So it'll tell the valence, which is what's happening right with both of us right at this moment.
Yeah.
And it's our prefrontal cortex then that's allowing us to regulate those emotional reactions. So if there's a disconnection, which I think is one of the theories in schizophrenia, is that then the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is not helping to do that regulation, not helping to say, oh, okay, this is really safe. I know you're afraid, and I know that this seems threatening to you, but it's actually a safe place. That's the regulation that's not there.
How did you get interested in this disorder?
Well, actually, I first started working at UCLA, and I didn't know very much about it. I was basically exposed to it only on a minimal level in graduate school. But as soon as I started working there and became exposed to the medical model, and then I saw how many components of it, I became completely fascinated with it and then decided that I wanted to study with it.
It's so interesting. I really think that those prefrontal cortical structures are the future. I mean, I really think that's where everything – that's really important in mental health. I got fascinated with the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, mm-hmm. which is more about the interpersonal and the social and that kind of stuff. And I'm fascinated with that area. And I'm thinking, how did I get fascinated with that? And how interesting that you ended up in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. It's weird. I don't know what that means about us, but I don't know. It's interesting sort of to think about that. But be that as it may, so you come in with people that are getting these early manifestations of these tracts and these regions being disrupted. You said the temporal lobe too. Does this
– The temporal lobe would be the place where hallucinations originate.
Okay. And is that some disorder of the visual processing system or
– Auditory.
Auditory.
Yeah. The most common types of hallucinations in people with schizophrenia are auditory. Visual is a lot less common. And basically, as you alluded to earlier, they hear voices. Unfortunately, the voices are often negative in nature. And you also alluded to the fact that paranoia is common when there's a belief system. It's often paranoid or negative. So these experiences are terribly negative, and the temporal lobe is where it seems to be the problem with respect to auditory hallucinations.
And these things can get very progressive and very severe and very disruptive of relationships and functioning. You're capturing people early. What is the goal there? Why early, and what are the treatment sort of structures you guys are using, and what are the goals?
Right. So we're trying to intervene early because we know that if you intervene early and provide people with medication and with good treatment, the likelihood that they're going to have a successful recovery to the condition is much, much higher. Intervening early allows the person to be able to get back on track with social relationship, with work relationships, and with family relationships, which are often disrupted when they have a psychotic episode and they're brought to the hospital.
So they come in, and what do you do?
Well, the first thing that we do is we just make sure that they're on a good medication.
How does medication prevent progression? You said there's a remission. Tell me what remission looks like and how that prevents progression.
Well, I think the main way that medication prevents regression is that it brings the auditory hallucinations and the delusional thinking under control.
Yeah.
If you're not paranoid and you're not hearing voices telling you all these terrible critical things, then you're back to being able to relate to people. You're back to being able to go to school or to go to work. So our whole emphasis is to get these young folks back to school or back to work. In the past, there was a belief that you had to protect people. If they had a psychotic episode, you should make sure that they don't do anything too quickly. That's still true. We want to make sure it's not done too quickly. But now we believe that the best thing for people is to get back into those relationships, back to work or back to school, so they could experience the self-esteem that goes along with those activities.
And I have noticed that some people do progress and some people don't. Is that just genetics, or is that something that to do with the treatment itself?
Well, I'm not sure if it's completely known why that is the case. And as a matter of fact, that's why we have funding from the National Institute of Mental Health, and we have some industry funding to answer exactly that question. And that's why we're focusing on the early course. Some people seem to progress.
And it's terrible when it progresses. I mean, it can be just devastating.
It really is. And I'll tell you, one of the best ways to prevent that from happening is to stay on the medication.
And does anybody know why, though? It doesn't intuitively make sense to me that...
Well, let's put it this way, right? The predominant theory is that in schizophrenia, you have an excess of dopamine.
Yeah.
It's the excess of dopamine that causes these positive symptoms. They're not positive because they're good. They're positive because they're there, as you know, because they're not supposed to be there. So you have paranoia and you have auditory hallucinations. The medication regulates the brain chemistry such that it reduces the dopamine levels.
Is it some sort of excitotoxicity? You know, remember that? Have you ever heard of that theory?
Yes.
The monoamines are spending too much time in the cytoplasm and becoming free radicals. The vesicle formation is off because it's being hyperstimulated.
Well, that's definitely a component to all this. Yes.
So that would make sense to why if you reduce the synaptic activity, maybe you're going to get less excitotoxicity, I guess.
Well, but think. Let's take this pathway. If you reduce the amount of dopamine, then you don't get these positive symptoms. Without the positive symptoms, then you have a chance at being able to function again. It's the paranoia, the auditory hallucinations. But let me add in another component that's just been more recently addressed, and that is the cognitive problems.
None of the cognitive problems, but I've noticed successful patients often use cognitive interventions too.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about that.
Right. So actually, that's one of the areas we're investigating at UCLA. We have a cognitive training program.
Let's explain to people what we mean by that, even cognitive.
Well,
just thinking.
Yeah, thinking skills.
Intellectual. Yeah.
I think of it as thinking skills. There's been a preponderance of research that shows that one of the factors that determines who's going to be able to return to school or work, one of the skills is the cognitive or thinking skills. In other words, if you're in a work situation or you're in a social situation, you have to be able to pay attention to what the person is saying to you to be able to carry on that conversation. If you get a job, you have to remember what instructions your boss gave you to be able to know what it is that you're supposed to do. And then there's a social component to work too, where you have to interact with other people and you have to get along with everyone. So thinking skills are needed for all of that.
Do you guys work on that? You give them CBT or something, sort of cognitive? I dealt with a psychotic patient recently who had a sort of cognitive checklist she was doing.
Mm-hmm,
she got very
mm-hmm.
good at that. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to assess whether something is a delusion or not. Is something an appropriate thought? Is a social interaction a paranoid reaction or an appropriate reaction?
Well, you're describing two different approaches. So cognitive behavior therapy does address the thoughts that somebody might have, the dysfunctional thoughts or the distortions, because even on medication, you can still have these distortions. So one way of doing it is to go through cognitive behavior therapy, which is exciting because you involve the person in an empirical way and you try to find out if there's any evidence for these thoughts that they have. The other approach is these web-based programs that are available commercially.
Oh.
You go on the web, and there are a series of exercises that improve attention, memory, reasoning and problem-solving, speed of processing. There are various puzzles and games that you play, and they challenge your mind, and it's all based on the idea of brain plasticity.
And this is stuff that you guys are doing in this aftercare program?
Yes, that's right. We're actually studying that specifically to see if we can improve people's thinking skills by providing them with time on these web-based programs. Then what we do is we have a bridging group. So they go into the learning lab and they practice these skills. Then in the bridging group, we sit around and discuss the fact that they've learned these skills and how they would apply them in daily life. Because That's actually the difficulty that we run into. They can learn skills and they can improve their memory in the learning lab, but it's how do you take what you've learned then and apply it in your daily life?
Are they actually having cognitive declines that you're trying to make up?
Yes, there is some cognitive decline associated with the condition. You lose some IQ points, and we are trying to make some of that
and
up.
And you mentioned memory a couple of times. Is it predominantly a memory and attention issue?
Yeah, some of the predominant areas are attention and memory. And I like to separate memory into two components, working memory and then long-term memory.
I'm groaning because working memory is what you lose when you age.
That's right.
And I miss my working memory so much I can't even tell you. That's why I'm having word-finding difficulty and, you know.
Right.
I used to be able to do three or four things at once. Now it's one thing at a time.
Right.
I hate that.
Right.
God, that drives me crazy. But I did talk to a neuropsychologist once who was saying, you know, people my age complain about memory, and whenever he studies them, they all end up with great memory, impaired working memory. It depends what kind of memory you're looking at.
Right. So we all are better at long-term memory than we are at working memory as we age. But imagine an 18, 19-year-old person, I don't have to tell you this, you know, who's robbed of the ability to have good attention and good working memory at a time when you really need it.
Well, that's what I've always had a sort of a question mark over my head about some of these web-based neuroplasticity programs, because a really rigorous academic program should be accelerating somebody's plasticity at a much higher rate than any stupid little, you know, card flipping program on the internet.
I couldn't agree with you more. So we view the cognitive training in the lab as a stepping stone and as one component of the whole treatment package.
Okay.
So the people in the aftercare program will be assigned a case manager. They are assigned a psychiatrist. They'll have a psychologist, and they have counseling. They have group sessions where they learn about their condition and learn about the importance of medication.
So psychoeducation.
Psychoeducation.
The family come into?
The family. We have family sessions.
Because that's a big part of it. People are so afraid of medication these days. They don't – particularly psychoactive medication.
Right.
They see it as some sort of giant conspiracy to defraud.
Right. Well, we're using the lowest doses possible and only enough to control these thoughts so that the person can function. And even we can walk a tightrope. If a person has an occasional bad thought, that's not a good reason for increasing the medication.
Right.
If the thoughts are overwhelming, as you well know, or you can't control them, then you have to increase medication. If you could stay at a lower dose, use cognitive behavior therapy to help you figure out the distortions from reality, then you can stay on that low dose and you can function.
That is the goal. I mean, medication, as with everything, has lots of side effects, and you want to avoid all that stuff too.
Yeah.
Is there one medication in particular that you guys are finding useful these days?
Well, right now we're actually exploring the difference between the oral preparation of risperidone, which is a second generation antipsychotic medication, and the injectable form, which is Invega Sustenna.
Mm-hmm.
And we have some reason to believe that this injectable form it may have some superior benefits to the oral preparation.
Just because of the sustained pharmacodynamics?
Well, that's what we believe, yes. That's one of our theories is that – but there's another component to it, and people, believe it or not, this might be surprising, are more compliant with the injectable form.
Oh, that makes perfect sense to me.
Oh, good.
Yeah, people think that's good. Something magical happening that they go to the doctor for. When the procedure is always – any procedure patients are all in for. It's when you're doing something, interpersonal or thought oriented or cognitive, then they're like, putting something in their mouth. No, that's no good.
Yeah. So the advantage of the injectable, when it was the 2-week preparation and now we have the 1-month preparation, is the person's not reminded every day. None of us want to be reminded every day that we have some illness, so then you have to take a pill. And I think we had more trouble convincing the psychiatrist that the injectable form was going to be acceptable to the patients, as you were just alluding to.
They didn't believe that it would be acceptable to the patients?
Yes.
Or they themselves were biased against it for some reason?
I think, but kind of a little bit of both. Yeah. I think, remember, like in the old days, oh no, you need an injection.
Well, you know what it might be? You know what it might be? It's if I know my resistance would be, geez, if they get a dystonia, what do I do? It's 30 days of this medicine. You know, so the side effects.
Right, but basically you can deal with that by using the oral preparation first for a couple of weeks before
Works.
Yeah, make sure it works.
And make sure that you don't get the side effects.
Yeah, but I think the resistance might have been, remember in the old days, oh no, I need an injection. That means I have a really serious illness.
Yeah, we save that for after we put the straitjacket on them, then we inject them.
Yeah.
So we're doing something to the patient.
Exactly.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. I'm talking to Dr. Joseph Ventura from UCLA Department of Psychiatry. It is the – name of the program again. It's called
It's the UCLA Aftercare Research Program.
And it is specifically for younger schizophrenics early in their course of illness. The website is schizophrenia.ucla.edu. We've also got some phone calls on hold. I will get to that and more with Dr. Ventura after this. Hi, I'm Dr. Drew, and of course it is winter and cold weather's here, and it's getting even colder. And for some of you, that means dry, itchy, so-called winter skin. Now, instead of using the same old anti-itch product this winter, consider using something new. It's called Tricalm. A recent study showed that it is more effective at reducing itch than 1% hydrocortisone, which is what you get over the counter. Tricalm works on skin irritation, and be sure it is in fact just irritation. If there's any question, of course, see your physician to make sure it's not a significant medical or dermatological condition. Tricalm is backed by the itch-free guarantee. If Tricalm does not stop your itch, you can mail them the empty tube, and you'll get a full refund. Now, if you have this so-called winter skin, get a tube of Tricalm for your medicine cabinet, your car, your desk at work. It can help. It's guaranteed itch relief that is more effective than hydrocortisone with none of the potential side effects of steroids. Find the white and blue box in the anti-itch aisle at Walmart, Walgreens, and CVS Pharmacy. Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Drew, and for you that are the members of the Swole Patrol, the runners and lifters, weekend warriors, injuries happen, especially as you get older. If you don't want to slow down for ice therapy, you can get Arctic Ease Instant Cold Wraps. That's right, you've never experienced anything like this before. It is a cold therapy you use while still active. You can be running, biking, lifting, and keep your joints or muscles wrapped and cool if that's appropriate. Arctic Ease Wraps stays in place while giving you similar recovery to ice itself. No freezer needed. The sleek design fits comfortably. No bulky ice. They're reusable. They're proven effective. Just put Arctic Ease on and you have targeted instant cold and compression therapy right where you need it before, during, and after exercise. Your choice. For pain, swelling, injuries, you can use safely Arctic Ease for instant, long-lasting cold compression therapy, even while you are training. That is the significant advantage, and you've got to try it. So don't put your training on ice. Get reusable Arctic Ease cold wraps at CVS Pharmacy and get instant cooling relief when and where you need it. Or visit Arctic Ease, ArcticEase, ArcticEase.com. We're going back to it. And we are back. As you know, I'm speaking with Dr. Joseph Ventura. We're talking about the UCLA... It's at the Center for Neurocognition and Emotion Research at UCLA Aftercare Program. Is it more than just schizophrenia being looked at there, or is it all schizophrenia?
All schizophrenia. Our approach is all schizophrenia, but there are other research groups studying bipolar disorder, autism. There's a wealth of research going on at UCLA with these various conditions.
And you call it an aftercare program, so it is for people who've already been hospitalized at UCLA or anywhere?
Anywhere, and we call it aftercare, but we can actually accept people who have not been hospitalized.
So it's more an outpatient program. Or...
It's an outpatient program, and I think what I want to emphasize is there's no cost to any person or family who qualifies for this program.
How do you qualify?
Well, you qualify by being in the early phase of your illness.
Do you guys have to make that determination?
We make the determination. We use structured research measures to do so. It cannot be a drug-induced psychosis. And it can't be a neurological condition. It has to be schizophrenia.
Is that hard sometimes these days to distinguish between an early schizophrenia and a drug-induced? Because there's a lot of overlap, it seems like. People will argue, oh, it's just precipitating early schizophrenia, that LSD or the pot or whatever it was they were using precipitated something.
Right. Well, it can be. Usually cannabis is not so much of an issue for us. If people experiment with cannabis and they develop some psychotic symptoms, we can still accept them into our program. It's those specific drugs, the ones that you know, that cause psychotic symptoms.
The hallucinogens.
Cocaine, methamphetamine. But if the person triggered a psychotic episode with drugs and then their symptoms went into remission, if they had another episode that was not drug-induced, then we can accept those folks well.
Mm-hmm. And so you bring them in, you determine who they are, and is it a five-day week kind of program? Is it all day?
Way it works is that in the first 2 to 3 months, they come in once a week, and that's when they participate in what we call our new patient group. That's when they get the psychoeducation. That's when we meet with the family members, explain what's going on, and explain to them why we're giving them the medication. They're also taught some coping skills, and we do a lot of very structured things like goal setting. especially when somebody's been in school and then the hospitalization disrupted their school, we want to make sure that they can get back to that.
You help them with that.
We help them with that.
So, again, so it's a five-day-a-week program?
It's one day a week in the first 2 to 3 months. Then in the second 6 months, they come in twice a week. And so they get cognitive training 4 hours a week, twice on Tuesday and twice on Thursday. Another component to the program is exercise. Where people would be, you know, randomly assigned, which to explain means through a flip of the coin, they might receive the cognitive training alone or cognitive training plus exercise. Because the latest thing we're trying to understand is whether exercise gives a boost to the cognitive or the thinking skills training program.
And that's probably a spin-off of observations in the general population that exercise improves cognition and delays dementias and things.
Right, in depression and the elderly. There's just such a wealth of information. You know,
a lot of these medications that, again, these second-generation antipsychotics stimulate appetite. So exercise is a good idea. Any dietary management or anything like that?
Well, that is one of the side effects of the drug that we use, risperidone, but it's a side effect of many of these second-generation antipsychotic medications.
Zyrtec is the worst. That's one they really eat on.
Yeah.
Risperidone, not that bad, but some.
Uh-huh. Right. The side effects are not as bad. That's why we selected that drug and want to work with that particular
one. Zyrtec is when people want to eat. They eat. They can't stop.
Well, or Zyprexa.
Oh, Zyprexa? Yeah, I don't. Zyprexa and risperidone go hands. Well, maybe it's because I'm a little afraid of Zyprexa, so I don't use bigger doses of that, so you never see the appetite stuff. Mm-hmm. Here's what I want to do. I've got some calls sitting around here. These are sort of non psychiatric calls, I think. I'm going to take them, and then we'll go back into our conversation here. So let's just take this call from Charles. He's 49, calling from Las Vegas. Charles, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Dr. Trudeau?
Good. What's happening?
I'm kind of in a little bit of a sweatbox. I was diagnosed with hepatitis C about 6 months ago.
Okay.
And, you know, I was told to come back and do the follow-up tests and whatnot.
Yeah.
Which I have not done.
Why? Why not?
You know, I'm scared to know what these results are. I feel like I have a death sentence hanging over my head. I don't know why. I've never been really sick before with anything. But
Charles.
Yeah.
Listen, I'm sure one of the things they want to do is do a liver biopsy, right?
Okay, yeah. Okay. You mentioned something about the liver.
Okay, and that's to see how much damage, if any, this hepatitis has done. There are different genetic strains of hepatitis. Some are more responsive to treatment than others. But you happen to live in a time when in the last year, medications have come along that make this completely treatable. And the longer you wait, the more damage there is to your liver. So get the hell in there and get the treatment, my friend. This is silliness. Do not let your fear and your frankly, I'm sorry, your lack of sophistication about what this is cause you harm. This is right now your anxiety is hurting you more than the hepatitis C.
I believe that.
Yeah, so go. It's a not just treatable, curable right now. Most of the subtypes are curable. So go and the ones that are not curable are highly treatable. So go take care of it. No one likes this. I just went through prostate cancer, dude. I didn't like that diagnosis either. But I went and took care of it, and now I'm fine. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I was praying for you on that. All right, doctor, I really appreciate
Charles,
it.
Charles, call me back.
You
let me know what they tell you after they talk to you, all right?
Thank you so much. Have a nice weekend.
Take care, buddy.
Bye-bye.
All right. Let's talk to Nick. What's going on, Nick?
Hey, Dr. Drew.
Nick, what's happening?
Hey, well, this actually has affected me less recently than it did earlier, but I'm 29 now, and I started getting pretty tough anxiety when I was hungover. So I really don't go out a ton either.
But, all right, so listen, hangover is a component of alcohol withdrawal, and one of the sort of hallmarks of alcohol withdrawal is tremor and anxiety. Your system is compensating for the central nervous system depression you've had, and it goes by going the other direction. So do you know anything about withdrawal at all? You sort of work in that field?
Not really.
No.
Do you have anything to add to this about he's getting panicky and anxious in withdrawal?
But what's going through your mind at that time? Like when you're anxious, what are you thinking?
You know, the night before, if someone I was around and I got drunk and I was slurring in front of them, like stuff that used to not bother me or something, like I just get
embarrassed about it, or a lot of the times it's nothing.
Well, like, when the hangover is over, do you still feel the same way?
Not really. It normally takes about 2 days, and then I'm back to normal, and then I'm kind of... Well, what I did is I just pretty much stopped drinking. But
good. Good move. It's a pretty simple solution.
I just didn't know if this was kind of a passing thing or if this is common with most people.
Well,
when it happened, I did a little, very little research, and it looked like a lot of people deal with this.
Well, they do. I think you're conflating two things. One is the shame of your behavior and your thinking about it with the accelerated anxiety people experience in withdrawal, which kind of makes sense, right? I mean, the negative symptoms kind of flourish together. But I think the thing that's most troubling to you is the shame. And maybe you have some shame-based stuff. Does cognitive intervention work for shame?
Yes, cognitive behavior therapy works for shame, but it depends on maybe did you do something that you should feel ashamed of, or was it something that was minor?
In college, I've definitely done stuff drunk that I'm embarrassed of, but recently I have a couple friends that I would say are about equivalent to Ray and Chris for Adam, and when I'm around those type of people, when we go out, and this has happened a lot less and less as I'm getting close to 30, but I know the guys I'm with have the next morning no concern about anything they did or whatever.
Let me ask something. So this is to me one of the most fascinating things that's happening right now for me is you and I are distributing into our two distinct regions of the prefrontal cortex that we're interested in, because the dorsolateral is more the cognitive behavioral, and the ventromedial is the more interpersonal. And I'm going to use my VMPC to make a maybe an insight that may or may not be accurate. But I'm wondering if when you were growing up, you saw one of your parents under the influence of a substance do some shameful stuff that you never wanted to be associated with.
No, I didn't. My mom and dad never drank in front of me. And, we had a boat, and I remember my dad would drink like Sharps, no Duels, and to kind of have something in his hand. But I didn't really see that out of him.
So
family members that don't live near me, I know that I come from alcoholism, and
right.
My job doesn't really allow me to do much drinking, and I'm, I tried to get a hold of you a couple months back when I was noticing this, but I just kind of backed off everything.
Well, good. So, it's sometimes the simplest solution is the best, right?
Yeah, I was just curious about it because it was really weird because I would get anxious, which I normally don't have. And it would normally be about nothing. There would be times I'd wake up and I would think, I drunk dialed an ex-girlfriend or something. And I'd start beating myself up over it. Then I'd check my phone and I didn't. And it was very strange. So,
let's see what Dr. Ventura has to say about this. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Well, it just sounds like that the shame that you feel about the things that you did gets exacerbated during the period of the hangover and the withdrawal, and that then it sounds like you're left with a little bit of it. So cognitive behavior therapy is the kind of approach that helps with distortions where people exaggerate things that they did and the negative consequences of it, and helps them to understand and put it more in perspective.
Do a 30-second intervention right now. Take a thought and see if you can reframe it.
You know what? It sounds to me like you just go out. You like to have fun. Once in a while, you may make a fool of yourself a little bit, but it's no big deal, and you beat yourself up over it, and you feel guilty when really you just went out and had some fun. So try to drink a little less, and you'll probably do fewer of these things that you beat yourself up over.
See? Simple enough?
I agree. And all right. Well, I appreciate it, guys.
All right, buddy.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
See, I still think at the core of all intervention is the connection, because you got through to him. That you know what I mean? He felt so reassured by that you could feel it. John, 25, Greensboro, what's up?
Hi there, Dr. Drew. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a question for you. My girlfriend and I, we've been going out for about 5 years now, and back in February, her stepfather passed away after an illness that was unexpected for about 2 months or so, and she and her mom went through that grieving process, and it doesn't affect her on a daily basis now, but the one place that it does affect her is with her sexual drive. She it doesn't really make her want to have sex that much.
How long ago did he die again?
In February. So it's been almost a year.
Oof.
And I think part of it, too, is also she thinks she probably gained 5 or 10 pounds, from the grieving process and that sort of thing. And she hasn't, she's not really doing much to counteract that or get that off, but she's not happy with that. So I think that's also contributing to her sex drive going
right.
down.
Right. Women very much are affected that way. What do you think?
Well, have you told her how you feel about this?
She's pretty aware that she knows that she's not, you know, fulfilling my needs. She still has sex with me, you know, like once or twice a week or when I ask, but it's always a chore for her, and she's just doing it because she feels like, you know, she has to in order to sort of keep me and that sort of thing. But it's clear that she's not enjoying it, and I obviously want her to enjoy it too.
Is she on any medication?
She's not, no, and she hasn't, I've encouraged her to see someone to talk about it and that sort of thing, and she hasn't been very receptive to that. She didn't really have she went to therapy a couple of years ago for something different. She didn't really have a very good experience there, so.
Well, are you certain that it's linked to the death of her, was it her stepfather?
Yeah, stepfather.
Yeah.
Are you certain it's linked to that?
I think that probably 60-70% of it now is the body image part of it, you know, from that. And then I think the rest of it is just that she just doesn't feel like she's in a state because of that. She's still sort of in the grieving process. I mean, she's told me as much.
Unless she's depressed,
like,
right? Is she depressed?
Yeah, she's functioning. This is really the only place where it manifests. Occasionally she'll have sort of moments of sadness where, you know, something will remind her, something will hit her. Like, I know Christmas is going to be hard for her and her mom, the first Christmas without him and that sort of thing. But she's still very functioning at her work and that sort of thing. So this is the only place where it's sort of affecting her negatively.
So the one thing you want to be very careful of is not blaming all this on the grieving and making sure your relationship is still working. Right?
Absolutely.
So
yes.
And if it is the grieving, yeah, I think getting her in to talk to somebody is the way to go, right? And we can't really evaluate at this distance secondhand. We're trying to evaluate somebody we're not even talking to. John,
right.
You want to say something to him? Or?
Is he still on?
He's still here. He's listening.
Oh, okay. So my suggestion would be to just reassure her that her small weight gain is not affecting you in any way possible, and just continue to tell her how much it means to you to have sex, and then perhaps just be satisfied with a lower frequency of it for a time being, and hopefully it'll come bounce back.
Okay.
Yeah, honestly, I do both of those things, and I make sure that, you know, she knows that I'm very appreciative, and it's less that I'm dissatisfied. It's more that I just want her to be satisfied with it.
I hear you. I hear you.
My one thing is just, what's sort of the normal time frame for someone who's grieving about this sort of thing? How long?
Dr. Ventura.
Well, if you talk to experts about it, they can say at least 1 year. According to some of the diagnostic and statistical manuals, they put it at 2 months.
Yeah.
So there's a huge variation in what people – it is very interesting. Yeah.
I usually think in terms of 6 months as a period after which you really got to look into it.
And I've heard a year. Yeah. And people who study the grieving process say that at least a year.
Yeah. So you're almost there.
Thank you very much, guys. I appreciate it.
Take care.
Take care.
And then finally, quickly, Brandy's 41. Brandy, what's up?
Hi, Dr. Drew.
Hey,
can you hear me?
I got you. What's up?
Okay. I'm just interested on your take on Lyme disease and co-infections of Lyme from tick bites.
What do you mean co-infection?
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out. I've been diagnosed with a co-infection of Lyme disease, Ehrlichia.
Ehrlichiosis?
Yeah.
Okay, so you have Lyme and Ehrlichiosis. Is that what you're saying?
No, the doctor said I don't have Lyme, but I have this co-infection, Anaplasma phagocytophilium, and he wrote down Ehrlichia.
Yeah,
here.
Ehrlichiosis. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's not Lyme disease. It's a different parasite.
Yeah.
So are you being treated?
Yeah, we haven't done any of the antibiotics yet. He's in the feeling of boosting the immune system through vitamins and whatnot first.
Is this a physician you're seeing, an MD?
He's an MD and an ND combo.
ND?
Yeah, naturopathic.
Okay.
But he is a MD also.
All right. All right. Well, I'm a little confused why he doesn't treat the infection, but okay. You must have seen lots of people before you did this, I imagine.
Well, he's the first one that has gotten the... We went through medical diagnostic laboratories, and it was discovered through ISA.
Right. So listen, you must have been through many, many consultants before you got to this point, right?
No.
You went directly to this guy with your symptoms?
I've been to other, not other MDs, but other naturopaths, and then I've been having some like fatigue and whatnot.
Why don't you get properly, why don't you maybe go to the University of Washington and get a really careful workup? And go with this, you know, this has been suggested as a possible diagnosis. And, you know, fatigue, you know, I think of brain when I think of fatigue. And you know, there's many, 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 many different reasons for people to have fatigue. Mm-hmm. How would you sort of approach that problem, I think?
The problem of fatigue?
Yeah.
Well, the first thing
somebody's seeing many, many naturopaths.
Well, I would get a better, more proper workup, and I think and the one question is it associated with depression?
I'm not sure she has that insight, and that's but people would argue, well, which came first? I was feeling fatigued, then I got depressed. I'm depressed, I'm fatigued. Mm-hmm. The point being, it's a complicated area, and it really has to be carefully managed and properly diagnosed. And if it's ehrlichiosis, then fantastic, but get that treated. I don't understand why you hold back on treatment if that's something that's the diagnosis. All right, so let's go back to talking about your program. How do people get enrolled?
Well, basically, they just call our main number, which is 310-206-3142.
Is there a website? Again, that's the schizophrenia.ucla.edu. And then look for the aftercare program?
Mm-hmm. If they call that number, they could talk to our patient coordinator,
We'll have that number up on my website. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then basically she'll do a preliminary screening. Then she sends out an email to the people who do the diagnostic and symptom evaluation. And I'm the person who does the screening initially. And then we could determine whether or not we would have the person come in for a full evaluation. We want to make sure that they have schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, or schizophreniform disorder, and that they're in the early course of their illness and it's not something else like a tumor or a neurological problem or something where a dual diagnosis issue where they need treatment somewhere other
for their
than
addiction.
Than what we could provide. That's right.
Okay. And what are you finding? Are there findings yet? Do you get a sense of where you're going with your research?
Well, I think one of the things that we're finding is that it is very important to stay on medication. It is possible to show signs of and recover from this condition. Cognitive or thinking skills are definitely involved in recovery.
I'm going to stop you about the recovery because you always think about schizophrenia as a chronic illness. Mm-hmm. So when you say recovery, you mean induce a remission or?
Yeah, by recovery, I mean inducing remission but not cure.
Uh-huh.
So recovery means that you're able to then return back to work or school. You can interact with your family. You can live independently and you can carry on with your life, perhaps have a family and so forth.
And most people still have some sort of personality changes and some cognitive. They're not the same as they were before the illness hit.
Often they're not the same exactly, but the goal is to be able to get them to a point where they could be happy with their lives.
And they're close.
Uh-huh.
Close to how they were.
That's right.
And most people are able to have full employ?
Well, it takes a lot of work. Mm-hmm. Regarding a full employment, there's a program that we use. It's called Supported Employment. This is also very interesting and exciting because at one time we thought that we would train people and then place them. The new thinking is you place the person and then train them.
Mm.
So there's the way we would think of it is you get a job coach. The job coach sees you through all the phases of employment or return to school. In other words, the job coach will sit down and decide with you what type of job you might be able to handle at a time?
In my experience with schizophrenics, to get full employment, they're usually really grateful to be working and really kind of joyous employees. Is that a general experience?
They are. They're very good employees.
They're usually very nice and they're enthusiastic.
They're very regular and good employees. Yeah. I think the difficulty is if they decide at some point, well, I don't really need my medication now because I'm working and I feel good. And then, yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah.
Right. So if they don't. So the idea is to do it in a stepwise fashion. You get a job coach. The job coach sees you through all the phases of it. And in some situations in Los Angeles, you might even be able to tell an employer that this person has schizophrenia. Most of the time, they don't disclose and they just get them the job. But the coach is kind of in the wings.
And what should you do if somebody is further on in the condition? Because very often, again, people are not getting to treatment. They're in denial. They hit the streets. They're forsaking their family or the family's forsaking them. What do we do with that group?
Well, some of these same principles would apply. Cognitive training to help with the thinking skills.
Do you guys do that also, or is there another program for that, progressed?
You know what we're hoping? We're hoping that we can demonstrate that the amount of resources that are required, although great, is worth the effort in the long run because you prevent chronic illness, you prevent rehospitalization. So that's part of what our approach is.
So now you're funded through the NIMH, and so it's free to the patient. And if you're able to show a standard of care, then insurances will have to start covering it.
That's right, because then in the long run they could save money. And so the state is also looking very carefully at these early intervention programs because as expensive as they are, they might be willing to invest the money in it for the long term. But the same general principles apply for people who are more in advanced stages. Unfortunately, there are not good resources for those folks in Los Angeles. It's just heartbreaking for all of us.
They're all – you can see them all on whatever that street is down by the Garment District. What percentage of the people on the street now do you think actually have schizophrenia?
The estimate is about 40% may have schizophrenia or some mental illness. Yeah.
Only 40% with some mental – I would think some mental illness would be more like, because addiction is so common out there, it'd be more like 80-90% if you put addiction in there.
You're probably right. Then the percentage of people with some mental illness is high, and then about half of those people have schizophrenia. So about 40% maybe have schizophrenia.
Okay. Yeah, it's heartbreaking too because they the lack of insight and how they're treated because they sometimes are scary or difficult to deal with. And I wonder if the injectable. Well, I'd have to ask somebody, I guess, who worked down there if they're going to try to get their hands on the injectables because that would be the population that really would benefit from that kind of thing.
If they're medication non-compliant.
Which most of them are, right? Because that's why they're there.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, or is it medication? Is it too late once it progresses for medicine to?
I'm not sure, but there is some indication that with each progressive episode you have, you tend to recover a little bit less. So you want to prevent yourself from having these repeated episodes. It's harder to recover from them each time.
Okay. I think that's a really important take-home message from people that may be struggling early in their condition or family that may be struggling with accepting a diagnosis. Get on it quick. Just the way Charles called with the hepatitis C. I mean, the longer you wait, the more the consequences. And the treatment work, there are highly skilled people that want to help. They'll be afraid of it.
If you have schizophrenia today, the main message is that you have to be very assertive in obtaining treatment for yourself. You have to ask a lot of questions. You have to go on the web. You have to do research. You have to understand all the different treatment options that are available to you and find the one that's the best that you need and most likely to be successful.
Can you describe a little bit what that landscape looks like? Is it confusing to people?
Yes, it's very confusing because it's hard to get that information in one place. And psychiatrists don't have a lot of time to explain these things. But you can go to the community mental health center. You can go on the web and find out information. The National Institute of Mental Health is a very important website, and also NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. NAMI is a community-oriented program that helps people and provides this kind of information to them.
And NAMI's terrific. So let's put the links up to and is NARSAT involved with you guys at all? Or is that?
We know about NARSAT. So NARSAT, yes, is a grant funding agency, and they do a lot of philanthropic work. They mostly provide research funds to people who have some interesting ideas. I just applied for a NARSAT.
Oh, good.
Award.
I would think you'd be sort of in their sweet spot.
Yeah, I'm a NARSAT Young Investor. investigator. I received a NARSAT grant at one point, and then I just submitted one as an independent investigator.
If you want to look up NARSAT, they're really an interesting organization. They're wonderful.
They have a new name now, Brain and Behavior.
Really?
Yeah, they changed the name. Yeah, the grants are still called NARSAT, which is the National Alliance for Research on Depression and Schizophrenia, but it's the Brain and Behavior Foundation.
Oh.
Brain and Behavior.
Oh, all right. Fair enough. Well, very good. Listen, Dr. Frontier, I really appreciate you coming and sharing your thoughts and helping some of the callers. That was kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully you'll get some calls and some inquiries as a result of this podcast. And anything else you'd like to say before we wrap it up?
Yeah, I think there's reason for optimism and reason for hope. I think we know a lot more about treatments that do work. I think it's a matter of finding access to them if you already have the condition. And if you're in the early phase, then hopefully if you qualify, you can come to the aftercare program and we could provide these treatments to you. But there's more reason for hope now and optimism than there was previously.
Fantastic. All right, that about does this podcast. Again, the website is schizophrenia.ucla.edu. We also have the links to the National Institute of Mental Health and the NAMI, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. Check all that out if you have any interest, and otherwise, we'll see you next time.
For call-in times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the Swingin' Sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. This is Corolla Digital.